Welcome everyone to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. And one of those cultures we keep returning to on this show is psychedelic culture. And to reiterate, one of my main points here is that it's not simply because psychedelics themselves are so fascinating, which they are, but that because of their heterodox, somewhat outlaw status, at least for many decades here in the West, they're also a place or a perspective from which you can see a lot of the underground currents, tensions, margins, counter-orthodox positions that have that animate our world. And so they're in intimacy with the language and the cultural expression of psychedelics really gives you a line into a lot of the more interesting interconnections of law and psychology and pharmacology and history and religion and magic and poetry. And they all sort of crisscross in this marvelously woven tapestry of peculiarities, marvels, insights, and occasional terrors. And for that reason, I really enjoy gatherings of people interested in psychedelics, because it's you never know what you're going to hear, and the conversations often range from the most, you know, dry kinds of neurological studies to these completely wild and bizarre metaphysical fabulations and everything in between. And so it's not like much else out there in terms of giving you a good conference. And one of my favorite conferences that's going, probably my favorite conference that's going now, is the Breaking Convention in the UK, a cheekily named gathering. I wasn't able to attend this year, but luckily I at least managed to get one of the speakers onto the show, so hopefully we can probe him for some reflections on the experience. I was at the last Breaking Convention, had a wonderful time, and I also there met the person we're talking to today, Alan Piper, who's a sort of a literary and historical scholar. And 2 years ago, he was presenting a paper on the topic of today's conversation, or one of the topics of today's conversation, which are the peculiar, underground, odds, and in some ways kind of somewhat significant connections between psychedelic culture, post-war psychedelic culture that we're sort of familiar with, the story that begins with Hoffman and goes through Huxley and Timothy Leary in the 60s, et cetera, and the connections that some of these figures have and some of this current of culture has with right-wing reactionary or at least very conservative thinkers and experiences, which is sort of, again, it seems kind of on the surface sort of against the grain, because we're so used to thinking of psychedelia as part of the counterculture and of thinking of the counterculture as part of the progressive movement, opening towards a sort of new age world of tolerance and multiple perspectives and indigenous views, critique of conservative mainstream culture. But in fact, there are all sorts of much more odd mixtures going on that are summed up well by the title of Alan's new monograph, which is called Strange Drugs Make for Strange Bedfellows, Ernst Jünger, Albert Hofmann, and the Politics of Psychedelics, which is a very handsome little volume. It's a good sign of the kinds of things people are doing with self-publishing these days. It's a nice big fat A1 paper, lots of interesting black and white illustrations, a reasonable price, and a very, very fascinating read. So I'm really looking forward to talking to Alan about that. So we'll bring him on to Expanding Mind. Alan, thanks for joining us on the show.
Hi there. It's glad to be with you.
Yeah, yeah, wonderful. So listen, before we get into your stuff, I'd love to just hear a little bit of a snapshot of Breaking Convention this year. How did it go? It had a lot of interesting characters on the roster. What was your experience?
What can I say, really, but that my feet have yet ready to touch the ground. So 3 days of the convention, Friday, Saturday through Sunday. I had Professor Carl Ruck staying with me Monday, Tuesday, and just put him back on the plane yesterday. But as you say, I described it as a smorgasbord of psychedelic culture, and covering an awful lot of ground. Yep. The legal side, medical side, scientific investigations and so on, and into the further out realms of DMT entities and their status and so on. I particularly enjoyed my friend Andy Roberts' presentation on Michael Holinshed, the could be described as the British Timothy Leary, who was an associate of Timothy Leary's. And the LSD culture in the UK, which Andy covered in his earlier book, Orbian Dreaming, is perhaps a slightly neglected aspect of a psychedelic history. And, of course, I was involved with that in my own small way, having grown up as a teenager in the late 60s and early 70s. So I think the culture was probably quite different from certainly the impression we have of West Coast culture, peace, love, and understanding, and so on. My experience was more kind of with Noel and I than Hate Asprey, should we say.
Well, this is it. For people who haven't seen With Nail and I, could you just elaborate on that? I mean, this is one of the interesting things that I found at Breaking Convention was that I there were very few Americans when I attended, and so I got a lot of European views as well as views from people from other parts of the world, but I was particularly interested, and Andy gave a presentation that year as well, about learning more about UK psychedelic culture. And I know, I think people are at least loosely familiar with the sort of festival scene and some of the ways that psychedelic culture went into the rave movement. But this distinction you're making here about maybe having a sort of different experience than the focus on peace, love, and understanding that at least was the sort of surface story of what was happening in the Hate. I think there was plenty of With Nails in the Hate at the time as well, and even more extreme characters. But in terms of that distinction you're making, what is that difference? What is that With Nail experience that was part of your exposure to psychedelic?
I could pretty thoroughly identify with sort of shabby bedsits in Ladbroke Grove and dodgy dealers and so on, with the famous Camberwell Carrot. For those who haven't seen With Nail and I, you have to see it. But it gives a perspective of a life of relative poverty, dodgy dealers, and my sort of experience, knocking on some back street door and asking, Indian Dave for some acid, which came as pink microdots and sealed between rolls of sellotape. But so I think everybody's experience is quite unique. But my experience at that time was I did attend festivals. I made one of the Isle of Wight festivals and some of the Windsor Free festivals. So they had that more kind of peace, love, and understanding, hippie-ish kind of aspect. But it was more, taking acid with friends in an urban environment and scoring some hash in a pub kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, but no, that makes sense. And then just a little bit more on Andy's presentation, Timothy Leary is such an outsized, figure within the cultural memory of psychedelics, but of course Michael Hollingshead played an instrumental role in his turning onto LSD with the famous mayonnaise jar. And in terms of your sense of, the way, you could have a long conversation about the way that the peculiarities of Timothy Leary's personality really influenced this large mass movement in certain ways because of decisions he made, how he decided to represent himself, how he decided to put forward his message. And while Hollingshead was not as visible a figure, he also had a lot of influence. And I'm curious whether what your impressions are of what kind of personality tics, if you will, that he had that really did end up having an influence on a lot of other people as well, because he was an interesting guy.
Well, I've got to say, although Andy, you know, presented on Hollingshead, I don't think it's enough for me to kind of describe him. He was obviously a kind of wild card, mixing it with the kind of bohemian, you know, literati of the day. But I think we have to wait, really, for Andy's book, or maybe for you to interview Andy, to have a real perspective on Hollingshead. I mean, he seemed to be involved with this kind of King's Road culture, which was something that was very remote from myself.
Mm. And King's Road was, that was the center, that was the sort of hate.
Well, kind of. I mean, that's... yes.
This is just being a central zone.
It was a center for kind of hippie clothing. I say hippie clothing, probably some of the more expensive kind of boutiques and so on. And so characters like, you know, Marianne Faithfull, Mick Jagger, you would see them walking along the street there. That was a kind of, it's Chelsea, which was a rich area. So so the affluent literati and glitterati kind of focus, I suppose, of psychedelic culture. And the kind of across the tracks would it be kind of Ladbroke Grove, Portobello gotcha. Road, and so on. Of course, the Mick Jagger film, Nick Rogue film is
performance
for a moment. The performance, of course, was set in that Ladbroke Grove area. So that was an area that I was familiar with. I worked down at Portobello Road. In the Electric Cinema, a kind of an offbeat kind of cinema down there. Actually, one of the oldest cinemas in London, if not the very first cinema, the Electric Cinema being its original title. But those were good days.
Yeah, those were very fascinating.
Greg Sams, I don't know if you know Greg Sams, but the Sams brothers, who set up a Whole Food bakery and so on down Portobello Road. And so that was the kind of scene that I was familiar with. Going back into my teenage years,
You know, it's interesting. I mean, you know, here we are. We're you know, once again talking about the 60s and 70s, which is the thing that people usually do when we're talking about psychedelic culture or trying to understand where it comes from. And your research of late, or a number of years now, has been to, you know, go back before even the 1950s and get into the interwar period and even earlier times, following a number of different sort of tendrils. And I'm just kind of curious how you first sort of got interested in that, and what was it that sort of called you back there to make some of these very interesting discoveries or presentations that you've made.
So, well, strangely enough, I mean, that takes me back really to that kind of, you know, Ladbroke Grove period of my life, where I worked in Electric Cinema, just collecting and sending out the cans and then spending the day reading whatever Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh or whatever took my fancy at that particular time. And funny enough, talking about Rajneesh, I mentioned his kind of interest, and some people have said that he's had a sort of fascination with the Nazis. But his suggestion, I was struck at that time by his suggestion in one of his talks that Hitler was on some kind of secret esoteric mission. And, you know, it was that even back then, so we're talking sort of 1972, 73, that kind of set some warning bells ringing in my head. And I describe a little bit within Strange Drugs, that I then read quite an extensive article in one of the New Age journals, looking at the Wundervogel, which I think you've mentioned yourself, in your discussion with Amy Hale back in 2014, which I listened to this morning, as a matter of fact. And I have to say that Amy Hale's work was very supportive of my own researches, and she was supportive directly of my own researches, which came to fruit in Strange Drugs Make for Strange Bedfellows. So early warning bells and sort of curiosity there, and, you know, having a sense that that people were moving out of drug experiences into New Age religions, some of which had an authoritarian kind of feel to them. And then latterly I was involved with an esoteric group that I started to sense had kind of nationalistic threads running through it. And lastly, after that, I sort of moved on and later studied cultural history. And it was off the back of those kind of early experiences that I got involved in as an undergraduate studying cultural history.
Very much. So what was your presentation at Breaking Convention? Was it the material in Strange Drugs?
No, it was not. It's kind of related, but my presentation at Breaking Convention was entitled Psychedelics, Transgression, and the End of History. And I spent some time worrying about choosing such a glorious title leading up to my presentation, but anyway, happily it was well received. And it was looking at a number of things, looking at transgression as an important aspect of modernism. That's to say, the kind of reaction against modernity, the character of modernity, the reaction against materialism, industrialization, and so on. So looking at that and talking about psychoactive drugs themselves as being transgressive, and by that nature being a technology that was well suited to a pre-existing culture of resistance in terms of the resistance of modernity that you saw in the arts and literature and music and so on, with Dada, surrealism, and such like. So, yes, so their character, this kind of subversive character in a sense, the idea of Terence McKenna, that he kind of deprograms you, from the meta-narratives of the church, the state, and such like. But of course, he assumes that once deprogrammed, you'll be embracing peace, love, and understanding, or something close to that, at least, perhaps. But my view is, as I think you're obviously aware, Eric, that that deprogramming of meta-narratives could move you to left or right, or in whatever direction really influences take you.
No, I really love the way you put that. I think in my own work too, I've come to see really the importance of, well, we could call it the avant-garde, as well as talking about modernism, in terms of where so much of this stuff derives from. So we're in a situation.
That is kind of my hobby horse, really, is saying, it didn't start in the 60s. You've got to look further back.
Right.
And there's a rich literature to be looked at there in terms of Walter Benjamin, for example, who I'm not deeply familiar with. But there's a lot of wisdom to be found. I mean, I mention Heinz Ewers, who was writing like 1901. He wrote a paper about intoxication and its uses in the creative arts, and which drug was good for this and which drug was good for that. So there's a rich history, and people need to look back further and have a sort of more nuanced view of the history. It didn't start just in the 60s.
But, I totally agree, and it is deeply bound up, I think, with this basic sense of the insufficiency of modernity, that modernity leaves some things out, and that in its sort of building and institutionalization, science, the rule of reason, a sort of moderation of behavior, kind of bourgeois values, sort of enforced through mainstream convention, et cetera, et cetera. That there's going to be a certain number of folks who are disaffected from that, including artists. And then, of course, in the late 19th century, arts themselves were full of sensuality, of aesthetic experiences, of deep, rich, symbolic, weird, dreamlike. All of the sort of elements that were left outside of the rationalist picture become the sort of materials for art. And that gets over only intensified after World War I, when you have this kind of crisis within Europe, a crisis within the arts, and this sense of needing to acknowledge and even sort of affirm the absurd qualities of life, the things that don't make sense, limit experiences, extreme experiences. And it's out of that mix that I think you're really right to focus so much on that interwar period between World War I and World War II, that sort of transgressive impulse we see as much on the sort of you know, anarchist left of Dada as we do in the right. And that's partly the place where the kind of connections that you're drawing really start to kind of cohere. Yes.
One thing I don't mention, of course, is Evola, who you know, he's this icon now of the new right, and was an icon of neo-fascists in Italy in the 1960s and 70s. Started off as a kind of Dada artist and poet, and that's something which I don't think has really been explored. There's very little material available on that period. Certainly, I think almost nothing in English, but it would be interesting to have a look at some of his artwork from that period. I believe some catalogues are available for those who have access to the libraries of any suitable galleries. But that's an interesting area to investigate. But just to give a fuller insight into what I was talking about breaking convention, I sort of move on from the issue of transgression and say, well, what happens when you have transgressed to the limit, so to speak? And what then happens beyond that? And also whether transgression, you know, has been commodified and sold back to us and has kind of, you know, whether we've kind of reached a kind of limit when you get to movies like Hostel, you know, the almost unlimited available of hardcore porn through the internet and so on. Are we passing a point where transgression has been, you know, assimilated into our existing culture, and in that connection, whether psychedelic drugs are being assimilated in the same way in terms of approved medicines. I'm not saying that I resist this, but in terms of approved medicines and in terms of appeals to religion legalizing the use of drugs for religious purposes. And whether in those aspects we don't see psychedelics being absorbed into the culture. And in fact, in many ways, I feel that the bomb has already dropped, you know, that it dropped in the 60s, and we're really living in the period of the fallout. And so, you know, are psychedelics ultimately kind of losing their mojo, so to speak, that inherently subversive quality that some people identify within them? And I just referred to a book review I think I was reading in The Guardian, the English left-wing newspaper, The Guardian, which just absolutely assumed that you had had experience of LSD in terms of the description of a novel or whatever that they were describing. So if you're white and middle class and of a certain age, then the assumption is you've taken acid and you can identify and understand the significance of acid experience.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, if you think about one of the main, you know, rules of thumb, one of the central protocols of psychedelic use from the 60s forward is this idea of set and setting. Mm. And you start thinking about what is setting, you know, how far does the setting go? Is it just the room with the fluffy pillows and the Bach music and the flowers, or is the setting actually the whole sort of cultural moment, including the cultural stories about what psychedelics are, you know? And so you get into this kind of recursive loop where the stories that we tell about what these drugs mean end up shaping and organizing the experiences people have and the meanings they draw from them. I mean, this is kind of a characteristic way of thinking about cultural history, but it's very visible with psychedelics. And so one of the interesting things now, and again, why it makes this such an interesting area to pay attention to, is what happens as these medical models, mainstreaming models, legal permissiveness, as these things change the cultural location of psychedelics, how much do they actually change how they mean? And maybe that they mean less, or that they become more medicalized and less about ontological terror. And on the other hand, it's as a kind of vehicle for religion. And so this is the point where I think being historians and being interested in and wanting to bring forward the history of these things, you know, particularly in the 20th century, the history in the modern world, more distant indigenous histories, play such an important role, because it reminds us that this is really you know, really a kind of moving target. And I share your sense that the transgressive edge, for better or worse, and it's probably a little bit of both, is going out of these things, and to some extent already has in in many ways.
I think that, I mean, what you were just saying, Eric, again, I kind of covered some of that in my presentation at the weekend, in saying that histories of psychedelics tend to be, you know, here comes psychedelics in the 60s, and then this is their impact on society. And in tracing this pattern of transgression as within the arts and literature and so on, and music as being central to modernism, so I was trying to paint a picture and say, well, this was the environment into which they were received. And rather than saying, well, here comes psychedelics and this is their impact, how did they become embedded into a pre-existing culture of resistance, if you see what I'm saying, this kind of anti-enlightenment culture that celebrated the irrational in the broadest possible terms. Yeah.
Yeah, very, very well said. Well, let's talk a little bit more about that zone. I mean, one of the things, you know, the points you want to make is that against, there's sort of a kind of generic, maybe not particularly deep or well-informed, a set of associations between psychedelic culture from the 60s on and progressive, you know, international, liberal, in the American sense of the term, positions, and that this, in fact, is not the case. It's not. It's much more complicated than that. And, you know, as someone who's interested in these topics, I've been aware of this. You know, I'm also, you know, interested in the history of esotericism, and you find the same set of issues, I mean, in a different light. In a way, it's more obvious if you study the history of occultism and esotericism of the last, you know, two or three centuries. It's very clear how there are both left-wing and right-wing elements and centrist elements as well. But it's very, you know, you don't have to go very long before you're reading somebody like Evola, where the politics are extremely problematic, and yet you recognize that he's also an original esoteric thinker, and so you have to start to come to terms with the way in which the category itself kind of blurs and spills over the neat containers we might want to have to control these possible energies. And I think with psychedelics, it's just been much, much less noted. I think the first place I noted it was reading Marcus Boone's book, The Roads of Excess, which is about literature and drugs. And he makes the point that before the 50s, the vast majority of people who were interested in, particularly in psychedelics, which weren't that many, but there were enough, were really more from a conservative side, and that's actually kind of a transformation, you know, in the 60s, and maybe not even an entirely complete one. So why don't, can you give us a little snapshot, whether it's the relationship of Hoffman and Junger, or whether it's a more general sense of that ambiguous status of how psychedelics appealed to people before the 50s, before this counterculture, and the way that they read them as having possibly very different kinds of political meanings and personal meanings.
Well, plainly the figure who's fascinated me is Ernst Junger, who was this close friend of Hoffman, and who Hoffman dedicates this whole chapter of his scientific autobiography, LSD in My Problem Child. He dedicates this whole chapter to the radiance of Ernst Junger. And certainly reading that chapter, although he briefly mentions some of Junger's earlier works, which he describes himself as being less comfortable with concerning a new type of man. He's referring there to Junger's work in English called The Worker. But you wouldn't know what a controversial figure Junger was. And I was interested by Hoffman's love, shall we say, really, almost of Junger, and to discover really who Junger was in terms of a bigger picture. And as soon as you start investigating Junger, you discover that he's best known for his descriptions of his experiences in the First World War, Storm of Steel, the translation of his first work, in fact, which I think had multiple editions and multiple versions, but his description of his experiences in the First World War. I think actually, having read it and having read another of his books on his experience in the First World War, COPS 1, 2, 5, I think it is, anyway, COPS whatever, followed by a number, which is just a strategic position on the front. Storm of Steel is actually a rather different character. The COPS, whatever it is, 125, should we call it, definitely is starting to move into kind of blood and soil kind of militarism that some people tend to characterise Junger as having. But his books are never without humour, even though they're describing people, you know, being killed standing next to him by a piece of shrapnel. But certainly one can't doubt that Junger's experiences in the First World War, the dramatic experiences he's had of life and death, shaped his worldview. But his drug experiences, as I understand it, go back to his youth when he experimented with cannabis from his father's pharmacy. His father was a pharmacist. But anyway, Junger is an immensely problematical figure. And so after the First World War, he was kind of involved in the youthful resistance to the Weimar Republic. The Republic was imposed on the German people effectively after the militarism of the First World War, and he formed part of the resistance to that, and was involved with some of the early kind of military, kind of paramilitary organisations and such like. And as described in Strange Drugs, he freely admits himself that, you know, as part of his resistance to the Weimar Republic, the democracy and those democratic characteristic of the Weimar Republic, that he was a supporter of the Nazis, as no doubt many other people were, who were not evil individuals and who were not of evil intent, but they thought that the Nazis were a good thing. But that he supported Nazis through till about 1938. He describes that in one of his interviews. And so that kind of opened my curiosity about Junger and how Hoffmann would have become such a close friend of a figure who, following the Second World War, in which he was in the German army, he worked in Paris in a dealing with correspondence, people's correspondence. Following the Second World War, he was an immensely controversial figure because of his close relations at certain points with the Nazis. The fact that he was a national hero and the Nazis essentially wanted him as a poster boy. So this seemed a problematical relationship, and I wanted to know more about it, and investigated this book, which happily had been translated into English, The Adventurous Heart, which Hoffmann describes as sort of opening his eyes. Now, actually, there are two versions of The Adventurous Heart, one going back to the 1920s and one published in 1939, and Hoffmann never makes it clear which version he actually read, but I'm sure he must have read both. But The Adventurous Heart, when you read it, the way Hoffmann describes it, it's all to do with kind of a deeper perception into nature and the sense of the kind of underlying forces, some creative forces within nature and such like. But it's a much more problematical document because it's a kind of set of vignettes, little descriptive passages, which may be dreams, which may be drug experiences, and many of them are quite violent. I'm not saying they're necessarily in celebration of the violence that they describe, but they're certainly, should we say, disturbing. Anyhow, the impression which I have is, and what is really fairly clear, is that that Hoffmann obviously was fully party to the medical aspects of LSD, of his discovery, and investigations into their potentially therapeutic benefits, their use as a psychotomimetic for an insight into schizophrenic states and so on, were investigated very early. Hoffmann sought Junger out as early as 1947, and he became, so to speak, Hoffman's guide, one might say, to the esoteric aspects of the LSD experience.
And, great. I want to ask you a little bit more about Hoffman here in a second, but we have to take a break. You're listening to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Eric Davis, and I'm talking with Alan Piper about the sort of secret history of psychedelics in the pre-war world and afterwards. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Expanding Mind Radio Network. This is Eric Davis talking with Alan Piper and talking about the influence of Ernst Jünger, author, sometime Nazi, anti-democrat, and a very kind of brilliant writer, and the influence that he had on Hoffman, and particularly, and this was, I thought, for me, it was the single most intriguing idea in your paper was the one you were just making, that for Hoffman, you know, he maybe wasn't the most, you know, whatever, deep poetic guy, I mean, very smart guy, sweet guy, you know, etc., that he was sort of looking for a way to make sense, to thicken the sort of meaning of experiences on LSD. And so while he and his company could recognize the potential medical benefits or psychomimetics and the use in therapy and psychology studies, etc., that for those deeper poetic sides of the experience, he in some ways found them through the resonance of those experiences with the kind of way of approaching poetry, imagery, and even fear and terror inside the adventurous heart. And I read The Adventurous Heart, and it's a very, very interesting book. You know, it's quite rich. It has a lot of different dimensions to it, and I think I was probably somewhat less troubled by the violence, the kind of gothic violence in it, than I suspect you were. But that may just say more about my own reading. I mean, I read a lot of horror and kind of fascinated by representations of nightmarish situations. And I thought there was a little bit more irony in some parts of it, and also some parts where he's clearly pushing back against the Nazis. That said, it's very clear the way that his whole project is really deeply bound up with this anti-modernism and taken to the conservative degree of a contra-democracy, the ideals of equality, and the sort of fetishizing of technology, of new more efficient ways of running the economy. All of this to him is sort of a twilight, kind of a nightmare. And what I want to get into, though, is how much, you know, how much have psychedelics served, whether in Hoffman's framing of them or how they went forward into the 50s and 60s, that in some sense they also carried these anti-democratic potentials, these potentials to turn against modernity, to turn against the order of reason as it was sort of installed in industrial democratic civilization. It's just how much of it is in the thing, how much of it is the stories that people are telling about it.
I would say nothing is in the thing, but just to return to Jünger for a moment and to be, for absolute clarity, Jünger was not a Nazi and was never a Nazi in the sense of a signed up member of the NSDAP. So he was in the German army, and an officer in the German army, and led his troops into occupied Paris on horseback. But he was not a Nazi, and he was close eventually to those who sought to kill Hitler in the July bomb plot, July 1944 bomb plot. And he was lucky to escape with his life. And one of his children was effectively executed by sending him into the front line for voicing his own doubts about Hitler's regime. So he was not a Nazi, but he was an individual of extreme conservatism. And the resistance to Hitler, the plot against Hitler, was by a conservative military, yeah, who wanted to save Germany from destruction when they realised that that Hitler was going to destroy Germany. But I wanted to make that point clear. In terms of, to come back to your point, if I correctly understand it, is there a potential in LSD for a particular frame of mind, the anti-modern frame of mind? Well, yes, I think so, because of the kind of mystical experience, essentially, that it gives you in terms of the world around you, particularly if you take it in a natural environment, the beauty of nature. And I'm trying to think of what my perceptions, if any, were of shall we say, mechanical contrivances under the influence of LSD. I think you could conceive of those as equally beautiful, but it certainly intensifies that aspect of experience. So potentially, yes, in terms of that resistance to technology. My impression is that Junger maybe had a very ambiguous relationship with technology. I've not been able to read his book, The Worker, but he envisaged, it's not very clear to me whether it's dystopian or utopian. Utopian, his vision of a kind of a militaristic, industrial, utopia or dystopia, whichever.
Yeah, I did manage to read the Glass Bees, which is a wonderful and really disturbingly prophetic book written in the late 50s, a novel, a futuristic kind of a science fiction, very essayistic science fiction. But he looks towards a future where the development in robotics is not the large-scale automata that dominates most science fiction imagination. Instead, he's looking towards a future of tiny little independent machines that work together in consort. And as he's describing the economies that go around these technologies, again, it's startlingly prophetic of certain aspects of West Coast, Silicon Valley ideas, the way that intellect functions in this new world, the way that entertainment functions, the sort of bad, sort of the captain of industry of this robotic entertainment world is sort of a cross between Steve Jobs and Walt Disney. Mm-hmm. And Bruce Sterling wrote the foreword to the book, and he remarks on how brilliant and kind of prescient it is in many ways. And he has the best line about Junger that in some sense, like all the reading I've done since reading your paper and becoming very interested in this figure, it sort of sums it all up. Which is, Sterling says Sterling doesn't really address any of the political issues. He just says something like, I suspect that Ernst Junger was a very scary man. So it's a beautiful thing. But we have about 10 minutes left here, and while we could keep going down, history lane, another important part of your piece is to bring it into the contemporary world, and we can say yes, there are these figures, these pre-war figures, these older figures, Junger, Carl Schmitt, there's a whole organization, and they clearly had a very profound relationship with Hoffman, who had his own, conservative side, which always seemed to me sort of fairly obvious, at least implicitly, in terms of how he carried himself and the way he spoke. But one of the other points that you're really trying to make is that today there are a whole host of much more explicitly new right political activist figures who are, kind of inhabiting the fringes of psychedelic culture and more centrally even in esoteric culture. And for them, figures like Evola and Junger are like, idols, very important sort of sources of meaning. And that there's some sense that there's sort of, how to say this, like it's people aren't aware of the full extent or the possibilities of some of these currents of thought, even though they begin to make their way into, psychedelic culture, into journals, into New Age magazines, New Age publishers. So what is your sense about that? Is there a real danger here, or what's going on?
Well, now, it's interesting you should ask me, use the word danger, because I was pondering, as I listened this morning to your interview with Amy Hale. Now, of course, she has this concern about entryism, so To say, you know, these figures from the right kind of infiltrating, shall we say, or creating a presence within psychedelic culture or New Age culture, and thus importing their own agendas into that milieu. And I'm not sure that there's a danger as such. It's hard to say, because the question in part is how big is this? You know, is it just a tiny group of, you know, eccentric, shall we say, who are fascinated with these figures like Carl Schmitt and Evola and Junger from a certain kind of right-wing perspective? It's hard to say, to have the measure of it. I mean, Kaplan, for example, has studied some of these groups, and I should perhaps return to that to get some idea of the size of the issue. But the thing that interested me really was that there was this kind of loop from the 40s and 50s with Hoffman's involvement with Junger, and then suddenly finding these figures, the Moynihans, Annabel Lee and Michael Moynihan, having this involvement within the traditions as a publisher for Evola, and Annabel Lee or Moynihan as the translator of some of Albert Hoffman's works, and then the journal Tier, where a lot of this comes together. So, and Tier, I have ambiguous feelings about, and no doubt you've seen editions of it yourself. And I actually say in my introduction to Strange Drugs, well, the world, you know, is a richer place. Our culture is a richer place for the presence of something like Tier, and yet, without going into detail, which, you know, you read my monograph, they are the Tier as a journal, which is essentially Evolian traditionalism, and elements of an interest in the new right, particularly Alain de Benoist, one of the major ideologues. Tier is a mouthpiece for him, and his interest in pre-war Volkish culture. It's a strange mix of a kind of quasi-academic, attractively produced journal. And my feeling is, well, let them do their own thing. You know, I don't sit in judgment on this, though my own limits are when we fade into racism, you know, as such. That is the point for me of no return, you know, the line that I wouldn't cross over. And unfortunately, there are connections with Tier across into the new right with Countercurrents Publishing and so on, where they're publishing books of a kind of extreme right kind of nature, at least white nationalist, shall we say, nature.
So, it's a strange situation. I also just want to say I appreciate your willingness and ability to just be forthright with your ambivalence. And it's one that I share as well. I have a couple copies of Tier. I've read it. I can, as someone who's interested in esotericism, it's even more blurry, you know, as you're reading along, where you certainly find yourself. And I also find myself in that situation where as soon as we get into certain ways of talking about race, I'm just out of there. I'm just, you know, it just shuts down. It's just like, there's no having that conversation. After a certain point, you know, they have their ways of organizing it, you know, racialism versus racism, blah, blah, blah. But I'm just not interested. And at the same time, I have to recognize the way in which my own criticisms of modernity, my own sense of nostalgia, or my own sense of the natural world, of what's being lost with technology, all these kinds of issues, are often dealt with very well by conservative thinkers. And so it's a strange place to find yourself. And again, I admire your willingness to go out there in a very, political environment, and to just try to tell the stories, frame things, you know, in the way you can, gently, and acknowledge that that the world is richer for these currents of thought, and that in those currents of thought aren't necessarily even that far away. Not meaning the nationalism or the racist politics, but some of the affects, the emotional experiences, the esoteric experiences, the dreams, the sort of experiential basis that some people have who go in that direction are very resonant. often with, more so with me than people who are, you know, on the, who have the same kind of political positions I do, but they're very invested in liberal institutions and science and da da da. And I'm like, oh, there's something, you guys are missing something. So it's a very confusing world.
It is. And there was a point while you were talking there, Eric, that I was just about to make. Oh, well yes. A couple of, I was going to say ironies, I'm not sure if that's the right word, but yes, the current situation. So I was fascinated by this kind of loop whereby Junger's close relationship with Hoffman, you know, Hoffman's kind of closeness to these conservative revolutionary figures such as Carl Schmitt and Armin Mohler and Junger himself. Plainly he can't have been innocent of, you know, their character, so to speak. And he was certainly, shall we say, comfortable in their company, but doesn't say anything necessarily of his own political views. And then the fact that that these figures like Junger and Schmitt are currently icons of the radical right, which stretches across kind of Nordic paganism, as that true, if I'm pronouncing that in the right kind of way, correct me if I'm wrong, and this kind of Odinism of various varieties of kind of Nordic paganism, Odinism, and such like. And I picked up Colin Cleary's, at least a recent collection of Colin Cleary's writings from Countercurrents, within which is As Actor and the Political, in which he says that he's unable to dissociate As Actor from white nationalism. It has to have that politics of ethnic identity. Otherwise, it's it's not As Actor, I suppose, from his point of view. And so I'd acquired that collection of essays that were published relatively recently, though I think it goes back to about 2012, where Colin Cleary is expressing that view in terms of that particular brand of Odinism. And then this morning, in the news, in this Icelandic newspaper, came the news that the pagan temple being constructed on Iceland, was coming under attack from radical Odinists for its liberalism. Was that something you were aware of?
Yes, I was actually. I've been following that fascinating temple. I don't remember the name of it right at the moment, but it is true that within the larger umbrella of paganism, although some people wouldn't, you know, are increasingly not using that term to try to cover all these different groups, you know, within those who are interested in the Norse mysteries, or what in, at least in America we tend to call heathenism, to distinguish it from paganism. Often people will say, no, I'm a heathen. And some of those people have the same kind of progressive values of most pagans. And some of them are right wing, and some of that also in America. Again, I don't know about the UK, but in America, it also overlaps with prison gangs. So you have white prison gangs are often identified with Odinist currents, and you can see it in the tattoos, and that overlaps with, you know, heavy metal, and so it's this very strange, you know, cultic milieu of mixtures. But I didn't know that they had, decided to really attack the temple for its multiculturalism. I mean, it's a very strange, idea.
If I can find it now, I'm frightened of opening Internet Explorer while I've got.
Well, we have about a minute left here, so we're probably just going to have to send our listeners
basically saying we're going to come over there and consecrate it ourselves. Yeah, and you should consecrate it. So, I mean, and so you are seeing there a kind of violent aspect and a determinism to confront the liberalism of certain kind of paganism.
Yes. Well, Alan, we're going to have to leave it there. Alan Piper, thanks so much for joining me on Expanding Mind.
My pleasure.
All right. Well, folks, the end of another show. Remember to keep your minds open.